From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Obama tells the nation he's taking action on immigration.
There are actions I have the legal authority to take as president. The same kinds of actions taken by Democratic and Republican presidents before me that will help make our immigration system more fair and more just.
A father reacts to the beheading of his son. It's the fifth by the so-called Islamic State or ISIS.
Please pray for Abdulrahman, or Pete, if that's how you know him, at sunset this evening.
And it's Snowmageddon in Buffalo, New York. Here's stranded driver Ron Dolce.
Cars are still going through and everything. A couple guys tried helping get me out, but I'm just buried. I can't get out.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Dana Bash of CNN, Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did the president get it right on immigration? Did Congress get it right on Keystone? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Dana Bash, chief congressional correspondent for CNN and my longtime colleague and friend. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Jess. Good to be on with you.
Thanks for coming on. Also from Washington, Indira Lakshmanan joins us. She's senior correspondent for Bloomberg News and covers U.S. foreign policy. Indira, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us as always. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Jessica, Dana, and Indira.
So it's been a busy week, and already there's new action on immigration reform. We're learning that the House Republicans, it seems, have already begun their response to the president, now filing a long-threatened lawsuit against the administration for taking this action. Dana, this is no surprise.
It's no surprise. The lawsuit, this looks like it was a story that's now being reported by the New York Times, is on the Affordable Care Act, on Obamacare. And I think what's most interesting about the fact that they've actually filed suit is that they found a lawyer to do so. They've gone through two law firms and had not been able to sort of find a working legal relationship, is probably the best way to put it, to come up with something that they thought was a viable option to file suit, and it looks like they have done so. But as you said, no surprise. And the reason why I think this is telling on a day like today is because it's probably a precursor to what they're going to do on immigration.
Let's talk about that. Give me just 1 minute. I want to play something that Mitch McConnell, the incoming Senate Majority Leader, said Thursday before the president made his speech. But McConnell warned of swift action if the president moved unilaterally on immigration.
If President Obama acts in defiance of the people and imposes his will on the country, Congress will act. We're considering a variety of options. But make no mistake, when the newly elected representatives of the people take their seats, they will act.
Now, the president then, when he outlined his plan, also said he's only acting because Congress will not.
To those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill. I want to work with both parties to pass a more permanent legislative solution.
So, Dana, we see a lawsuit to stop the executive action, but what's the likelihood that the new incoming Republican Congress will pass a bill?
It's unclear. I mean, that's the truth. Well, let me just actually rephrase that. When it comes to the kind of move that the president made last night to effectively allow nearly 5 million undocumented immigrants to stay legally, the chances of that passing this Congress is zero. I mean, let's just be honest. And that is why the president wanted to move ahead. It's not that Congress can't pass a bill. It's just that they were never going to pass a bill, particularly with a new Republican majority in both sides of the Capitol. They were never going to pass the kind of sweeping move that the president made last night. And so that, I think, is one of the many layers of frustration you're hearing from Republicans is, you know, kind of give me a break. It's not that we can't pass a bill. It's just that we can't pass a bill that you want. And that's kind of not how democracy or the world should work. This is a Republican argument.
Jack, this gets to the whole question of the president's action. Was it legal or not? The action in itself grants deferred action to two groups, parents of U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents who are in the country for 5 years or more, and young people brought in the U.S. legally as of 2010. You think his action is up for legal challenge?
I doubt it. I mean, at least to read the law professors and the blogs. For example, the Supreme Court declared in U.S. v. Nixon, the executive branch has exclusive authority and absolute discretion to decide whether to prosecute a case. Now, the government, there are 11 million, an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants. The government budgets, the Congress provides a budget to deport 400,000 of them a year. Therefore, discretion is just built into it's a necessity. And what the president is saying here is this is within my power to decide who goes and who stays. And the criterion should be, you know, legality. Do you obey the law and all felons, not families, as he says. But beyond the legal issue, which I don't think is going to be contested at any, of course, you can never tell with this court, but at least in looking around, it doesn't sound as if that's apt to happen. But beyond that, there is just the political imperative on both sides. The president, you know, politics drives policy. The president just last year, just earlier this year, was called by a leader of La Raza the deporter in chief. He can't, you know, that's a curse on him and on his party. They lost Hispanic votes sometimes in some races dramatically in this election. He had to respond to that constituency. On the other hand, the Republicans have to respond to a constituency that wants confrontation with the president. By 66% in one recent poll, Republicans want not compromise, but more confrontation.
Dana, there are a few people in Washington who knows Congress and the mindset of the incoming leaders as well as you do. I'm curious if
for better or worse.
Right? I'm curious if you think that this has, in fact, as Speaker Boehner put it, sort of poisoned the well for the chances of this Congress working with the president, not only on immigration, but on other issues.
I do think it has poisoned the well, but it's not because of the relationship between the leaders. I think at the highest levels, between the president and the speaker and Mitch McConnell, you know, they're big boys. They get it. They understand politically, tactically, why the president is doing what he's doing. But that's never been the issue. That has never been why there hasn't been compromise in, you know, years. The reason is because, as we were just hearing from Jack, the rank-and-file Republicans are so adamant about sticking to their guns, are so distrustful of this president, that it was already hard for the leadership to bring along the rank and file. I mean, that's why the government shut down last year. John Boehner didn't want the government to shut down, but he says, you know, when you're a leader and there's nobody following you, you're just a guy taking a walk in a park. So that's why I do believe that it is going to make it more difficult, not because of the leaders, but because they're going to have an even tougher time convincing conservatives who, remember, most of them, especially in the House, come from gerrymandered, very ruby red, rock red districts to compromise, to come up with some kind of legislation to help a Democratic president with his legacy. I mean, that's the way they view it.
Hmm. Let's take some calls. Folks have strong feelings on this immigration move. Stephen is calling from Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Stephen. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know how you guys feel, but doesn't this have a sort of cynical political timing feel? I mean, if you waited a couple of months, this Congress he has now, of course, wouldn't have passed anything. But the next one, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, let's be honest here, could have split through the Democrats and got through some legislation that they could all sign. But this just adds to more cynical politics, you know, and then you got to play it through. Like the West Wing didn't think about it. The Democrats are going to dig a Mitt Romney with these legal precedents backing them up.
Stephen, you've got a lot in there, and I hear what you're saying. Not only are the critics of the president from the Republican side saying it's cynical, but some on the Democratic side say it was cynical for him to wait this long to do it, that he should have done it during the election. So taking fire from all sides. Let's take a call now from Craig calling in from Onalaska, Wisconsin. Craig, did I pronounce that right? Onalaska?
It's Onalaska.
Okay. What's on your mind?
Well, I blame both the incoming Senate Majority Leader, Mitch, and also the Speaker of the House, Boehner, for not stating publicly that they would take something up in the new Congress as one of their first things. They're acting, and I especially blame Boehner, because he's been acting more like a dictator and a king and an emperor than Obama. I don't like what Obama did, but I am a supporter of Obama. But I do not like what he did. But I blame the two Republicans for not publicly coming out and saying, we're going to do it.
Craig, thank you for your call. Dana, you mentioned a moment ago the shutdown of the government that happened in the past. There has been some talk that Republicans could try to shut government down again to block this executive action. What are you hearing on that front?
Not going to happen. I mean, listen, I would not bet my life savings on it, because I've seen things change on a dime, but there's no desire to do that. And there are lots of reasons why. Actually, you could sort of look at the counter argument to shutting down the government and say, well, Republicans thought that they were going to get in trouble with the voters for shutting down the government last year, and look what happened. They expanded their majority in the House and they took over the Senate. So there was no voter retribution for it. However, Republicans actually do have some things that they want to get done with their Republican majority. They don't know how long they're going to have it, and they don't want to be distracted. They don't want to be distracted with a government shutdown, and they know that that would be the thing that would happen.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a big week in the news. You can join our conversation. What stories are you watching this week? The horrifying synagogue attack in Jerusalem? Power plays in Washington? We're talking with Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, Dana Bash of CNN, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Dana, before the break, you were talking about the GOP's chances of shutting down the government. Not likely. How about their chances of just funding it for a few months at a time so that Washington is almost unable to function?
That's really the open question now, Jessica, is how they're going to keep the government running at this point. It runs out December 11th, and I think sort of taking it up to 10,000 feet here, this is kind of the world that we've been operating in, because the subject of spending and government funding has been so toxic that we have been in what's called continuing resolutions for a long time now. And what that means is that they just kind of kick the can down the road without stopping and looking at the funding and spending priorities, which is Congress's real, that's their main job constitutionally to do that. So right now where we are is that there actually has been, hold on to your hat, bipartisan work, pretty intense bipartisan work on a new spending bill to go through the entire year, which is not a continuing resolution. It's actually new priorities, new discussions. And so the question is whether or not that is going to continue, whether Republicans are going to allow that to happen, a year-long spending bill, or whether or not they're going to just say, let's just do it for the short term, because they want to have the opportunity to try to attack at least some of the president's immigration changes through the funding process. But I'll just add one more quick thing about that and the danger in that, really the challenge in that for Republicans, is much of what the president announced last night will be funded not by Congress, but the customs agencies are funded by customs fees. So they're actually quite limited, even with their power of the purse, in changing this policy with that power.
Interesting. So jury's out on exactly how the Republicans will respond and whether the budget is even going to have an effect. I'd like to do a hard gear change here for a moment, because there is a lot that happened this week, including the tragic fifth beheading by ISIS and the Islamic State. This week, it was 26-year-old Peter Kasich, a U.S. soldier who returned to the region to provide medical aid to victims of war and in captivity converted to Islam. Indira, I'd like to bring this one to you. The U.S. continues its effort to stop ISIS with targeted bombings. How effective has this been?
Well, interestingly, while at first the United States was saying that it was going to take years, this fight against ISIS, and that we shouldn't be expecting any change in the short term, we have seen what looks like some changes in behavior from ISIS, which shows that they seem to be somewhat on the run, suffering some setbacks. One example of that is that they are now apparently doing their offensives on cloudy days when they wouldn't be as visible from drone strikes. Also, they are now not moving convoys with huge numbers of people, but more traveling by motorcycle or single car. So, there are some signs that they are actually on the retreat. And, you know, part of that has also been the empowerment of some of these Shia militias by the Iraqi government, militias that certainly have been criticized for human rights violations as well. But we also see the empowerment of the Sunni tribes in Anbar province. And that is also something where you see people in Iraq increasingly getting fed up with ISIS and rising up against them. So there does seem to be some sign that the coalition strikes are having an effect.
And Indira, another pressing issue in the region, Iran's nuclear ambitions. Secretary of State John Kerry is right now overseas, and he's trying to finalize a deal to halt Iran's nuclear ambitions before an agreement dies at midnight Monday night. It's clear they're running out of time. How likely are they to reach an agreement? And if they do, what are the contours of that?
Yeah, this is a story that I've been covering very, very closely for several years now. And it's been interesting because a year ago at this time, I was in Geneva in what was at that time the third round of nuclear talks in, you know, the first communication, really, between the U.S. and Iran in many years, the first open communication and the first real negotiations. And we did end up getting a deal in, as you say, not just the 11th hour, but the 12th hour. It was, you know, into the morning by the time the deal was gotten. We were all sitting at a press conference at something like 4 o'clock in the morning. I think this time it's tougher because we're talking about a comprehensive deal, not an interim agreement, and one that would include a long time period. The U.S. wants 20 years. Iran only wants 5 years. That would include limiting the number of centrifuges. That would also be about verification. That would be about how much sanctions are lifted and how quickly. And, you know, these are all really tough issues. And we've heard varying reports today out of Vienna about whether the Iranian foreign minister Mr. Javad Zarif is actually going back to Tehran today, which would be in some ways a positive sign, I think, because it would show that he's going back to consult with the leadership in Tehran about how much he's able to compromise. So at this point, I think the betting person would say that it's most likely that there will be another extension come Monday, that it's unlikely they would get a final deal. But you never know. There always is a chance for some sort of 11th hour compromise.
Let's listen to what Secretary of State John Kerry said when he insists that negotiators on the deal will not settle and they're committed to an agreement that prevents Iran from getting the bomb.
Yes, we do want to get an agreement, but it's not just any agreement. It has to be an agreement that works, that achieves the goal of guaranteeing that the pathways to a bomb will not and cannot be used.
So, as you say, Indira, we are waiting to see what evolves with that decision as the clock ticks down. And we can switch gears and take a look at a new escalation in tensions also in the neighborhood in Israel, a devastating slaughter that brought both new fear and new tension to Jerusalem. At this week's end, Indira, what are we looking at there?
Yeah, I mean, this was really a terrible attack, an early morning attack on Tuesday where you saw two Palestinian Israelis going into a synagogue early in the morning, two cousins, and attacking with a gun and with machetes the men who were praying and ultimately killing four men who were praying, three rabbis, actually one of whom from a very prominent Boston rabbinical family. And the fifth man who was killed was one of the security forces, the Israeli security forces who came in to put down the attack. You know, this is just the latest in a series of these horrible terror attacks that we have seen in the recent months. And also there have been sort of retributive attacks back and forth and retributive actions. And let's, if we take this back to its logical beginning, at least from this year, it was the collapse of the U.S. brokered peace talks in April, I would say. And then we saw Palestinian militants in the West Bank kidnapping and killing three Israeli teenage boys in the beginning of June. And within a few weeks of that, Jewish extremists had kidnapped and killed a Palestinian teenager who had nothing to do with the attack on the Israelis in a really sick revenge attack that happened in Jerusalem. And, you know, we've just seen attacks back and forth, particularly in the last few weeks, some horrible attacks on Israelis, people driving their cars onto groups of pedestrians on the sidewalk, a baby girl who was killed recently. So, you know, it seems as if it's a new spiral of violence in a place that is, of course, used to a lot of violence. But what I thought was interesting is that a lot of people are saying that now it doesn't just have the political dimension about land that it has had for so long, but it's now taking on a religious dimension much more so than it has in the past, which is really difficult because there are a lot of Palestinians who believe that the Israeli government is trying to change the status of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock and allow Jews to pray there. And Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has said repeatedly, we have no intention of doing this. But there, you know, there is a belief in the Palestinian community that that such plans are underway. And that has fed a lot of the resentment and now violence.
And from the Israeli perspective, the sight of so much blood and violence inside a synagogue has horrifying echoes to them of the Holocaust as well.
Absolutely.
So religious concerns on both sides. Let's listen to some of the reactions from the region. This is from an interview with CNN when Palestinian official and activist Hanan Ashrawi first denounced Tuesday's devastating synagogue attack, but then expressed deep frustration with Israeli leadership.
We've even said that Netanyahu is provoking probably a holy war by targeting Muslim holy sites. And we said that such policies have to stop. Otherwise, we will be plunged again into this spiral of violence.
So one perspective that that attacks the Israeli government. But then on Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister spokesman Mark Regev also talked to CNN from Jerusalem, saying that the Israeli government wants the Palestinian leadership to do more to distance themselves from the terrorist leadership, Hamas.
I think it's now time for everyone in the international community to be saying clearly to the Palestinian leadership, get off the fence. It's time that you broke your political pact with Hamas. It's time you disassociated yourself from these extremists. And it's time that you move into the mainstream of humanity in total and utter condemnation for this sort of atrocity.
Jack, you hear them trading accusations. Who is to blame for escalating tensions there? Do you think that U.S. leaders can do more?
Oh, you know, I think Secretary Kerry made Herculean efforts, I think, in the spring. He claimed, and then backed away from the claim, that it was a move of Prime Minister Netanyahu's that made the talks go poof, as he said. On the other hand, there are claims that the Palestinians weren't going along. Look, you know, I've been looking back at Lawrence Wright's book about Camp David, and the only, you know, the 1978 agreement between Egypt and Israel to withdraw settlements from Sinai. Key to that was Jimmy Carter's absolute commitment to take risks for peace. He told both sides, I will move to cut off U.S. aid unless you agree on this. And Egypt was just then breaking from the Soviet Union, needed U.S. aid badly. And of course, Israel was a client of the United States. And that kind of commitment seemed crucial to getting the deal done. No American president, George H.W. Bush, perhaps with a slight exception, has been able or willing to go that far.
Dana, quickly, if you would, on a practical note, even if the president were to try to cut off aid, say to both sides, to be balanced, any chance that would pass the new Republican Congress?
No. And that's an excellent and important point here, is that already you had, with Democrats in control of the Senate and Republicans in control of the House, a very pro-Israel Congress, a very skeptical of Iran Congress, and that is going to just amplify big time when Republicans take over the Senate.
And there's no indication the president would consider altering aid to any extent. Let's move on for a moment now, because there is also a lot happening on the Senate floor this week, first with the Keystone Pipeline. Here's Mary Landrieu. There, I should point out there was a vote on Keystone. It failed by one vote in the Senate, and it's widely considered to be a blow for Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu, who was actually hoping the bill would help her win her December runoff for reelection.
There was a lot of politics going on about this before the election, and you all that have followed this know that as well as I do. But there was an opportunity. This was not on Harry Reid's agenda. It most certainly was not on Mitch McConnell's agenda, but it's been on my agenda, and it's staying on my agenda. And I'm going to do everything I can to help America become energy independent.
Well, Dana, the words sound optimistic, but she sure sounds pretty downcast there. Did this scotch her chances at reelection?
You know, she already had a very uphill climb to win her runoff in December. But she is a Landrieu, and she is from Louisiana, and they have pulled it off before. I've seen it with my own two eyes about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when she had another runoff. But, Jessica, you know, we used to cover the Hill together. There still is, even though there's a ton of tension and everybody's sort of out for themselves, there is still a sense of clubbiness and frankly, you know, sisterhood. And it just wasn't there. And I still, to this day...
It wasn't there for her?
And no, I'm still there. I'm shocked. I'm shocked that it lost by 15... By one vote, that she only got 59 votes. I was sure that she was going to convince somebody who is retiring and has nothing to lose, somebody who is in leadership and wants to try to help her, somebody, one more Democrat, to come along and just say, okay, Mary, I'll walk the plank for you.
Interesting. You think they're all worried about their own political skin?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think it's some worried about their own political skin, you know, especially those who have... aspirations for higher office, because this has become a very, very big divide. Environmentalists have made this sort of their clarion call. On the other hand, on this note, you know, you do have people like Jay Rockefeller, who I talked to in the hallway. He's retiring. He's from a state that could potentially benefit from something like this. Not directly, it wouldn't go through the state, but because it's an energy producing state. And he just said, you know what, I'm not going to do it. He considers this a poor choice environmentally. He doesn't believe the argument that it's going to create jobs, and so he said no. And there were enough Jay Rockefellers that it didn't work. But I have to say, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I don't think that this kind of thing would have happened. I think the Mary Landrieus of the world would have convinced one of their colleagues to come along, and it just is proof that the collegiality of the Senate, the club of the Senate, isn't what it used to be.
Let's go to the phones for a moment. Drew is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Drew, you have a comment on the Keystone Pipeline?
Yes. I just wanted to say that I think a lot of Republicans in Congress and other members have been highlighting job creation from the Keystone Pipeline. And although it's estimated about 35,000 plus jobs will be created, it's important to realize that virtually all of these are just part-time jobs. And is that worth it for having a foreign country basically force eminent domain on our citizens? I just don't know if that's worth it. So
you're glad it failed?
I am glad it failed.
Okay. Thanks so much. Drew, that's Drew calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Again, the pipeline could bring oil, unrefined oil from Canada down to the Gulf refineries through U.S. land. Dana, just briefly, if you would, the Republican Congress still has a chance to vote on this in next year. That Keystone measure is likely to pass.
Yes, it is likely to pass. Because 10 of the Democrats who voted yes are still going to be in the Senate next year, and you're going to have at least 53 Republicans. So it's going to pass, but it's not likely to pass by a veto-proof majority. So then the question is going to be, then what? And, you know, it is going to put into question whether or not this is one of those horse trading possibilities for the president. If he does want to cut deals, this is something he can use.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, Bill Cosby. At least 9 women have spoken out, accusing him of sexual assault. His lawyer denies the charges. Cosby himself isn't commenting. Here's what he said during a just-released interview with the AP.
I think you were told. I don't want to compromise your integrity, but I don't talk about it.
Famed director and Hollywood icon Mike Nichols died this week at age 83. Here he is talking about his storytelling process.
I think you find what's happening under the words, the story that is not in the words. You have to dig out the events beneath them. You have to find the events.
And you might not know the name, but you'll recognize the sound. Motown singer Jimmy Ruffin died this week. Here's his biggest hit, What Becomes of the Brokenhearted.
What becomes of the brokenhearted? Who had love that's now departed? I know I've got to find some kind of peace of mind, maybe.
You can join the conversation. Are you snowed in today in Buffalo? Call us. Do you plan to spend the weekend watching your favorite Mike Nichols movie? If so, which is it? I'm joined by Dana Bash of CNN, Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's turn, guys, to the vote this week on the USA Freedom Act. On Tuesday, the Senate had a chance to make cuts to the existing surveillance powers of the NSA. This measure would have prohibited the government to sort of have carte blanche access to U.S. phone records and would have created a board to argue before the secret FISA court in favor of civil liberties. Dana, you cover Congress. You know these guys. Were you surprised this one failed?
I was, you know, and the reason why it failed was so interesting in that you had Republicans pretty much voting in block, a lot of them, because they thought it didn't go far enough. And then you had, on the other side of the Republican spectrum, Rand Paul, who you would think would be for NSA reform, voting against this because he didn't think it went far enough. He did not think that the reform was far enough, because ultimately what he wants to do is just completely get rid of the Patriot Act. And so you had him on the other side of the ACLU, which thought that this was okay, which was really kind of bizarre world in the Senate. I was a little bit surprised, but it also was, to me, very telling of the kind of debate we're going to have, particularly within the Republican Party. On the 2016 front, you really are going to have a very big divide between Rand Paul and the sort of civil liberties wing of the Republican Party and the Marco Rubio wing of the Republican Party, which says if you take away these rights of the government, then you're going to hurt security of the country.
Jack, you know, Rand Paul said he voted no, as Dana says, because he wanted to go even further. But there are those who supported the measure say they might not have the chance to go further in the new Republican Congress.
That's right. And coming up, I think in June, Dana can correct me, but sometime around there, the renewal of the Patriot Act is going to be on the table, and that will open this whole debate and put Rand Paul, I should think, in a starring role. You know, it was interesting. I had the sense that the bill that the Senate was voting on had been so weakened in the House, the reform measure, that the civil liberties lobbies weren't pushing it, and therefore the Democrats didn't, you know, there wasn't as much edge in the vote as there could have been. Is that about right, Dana, that there wasn't so much enthusiasm?
Yes. I mean, I think part of the problem is that the Democratic leadership, they were monitoring it, but they weren't whipping it, meaning they weren't twisting arms. And that's why the Democrat from Florida, Bill Nelson, was able to vote against it without anybody knowing he was going to do that, causing a little bit of chaos on the floor. You're right.
So, Dana, is it likely that when the Patriot Act is voted on again next year, they'll have to at least find a way to address these issues? It's even in a Republican Congress, it's not likely that they'll simply ratify what already exists, is it?
No, it's not likely that they're going to ratify it. And you're right, and Jack's right, that it is going to come up, and it is going to be a big issue. But I think that I know that the disappointment among the people who worked very hard on this reform is that, as you said, they're not going to get, maybe it was weak for reformers, but it won't be weak compared to what the majority of the Republicans will want to do with something that has even more teeth when they take control.
Let's take a look at a domestic issue now. Ferguson, Missouri. As we go to air, we are still waiting the grand jury decision there. And already the governor, Jay Nixon, has declared a state of emergency and activated the National Guard. Here's Missouri Governor Nixon explaining why he took this decision.
People need to feel safe. But everything we're doing is being driven by the dual objectives, what I call the dual pillars. You know, keeping the public safe while allowing protesters to speak.
Now, some say it's unnecessary to do that because there is calm on the streets. Jack, what are you going to be watching for in Ferguson? And I should point out, as we go to air again, we are still waiting on this decision.
Well, people pretty much agree that the grand jury is probably not going to indict the officer, and therefore the possibility of a provocation is just built in. I hope, frankly, that the evidence that led that grand jury to that conclusion is laid out carefully, thoroughly, and with a kind of prophylactic intent. In other words, if you're a fair-minded person, even someone who feels that police overreact and that, you know, walking while black and being a black, all of that, even if you say all of that is true, nevertheless, here is evidence that a fair-minded person could point to and say, no, this wasn't an injustice. Something happened between the young man and the officer. There was an affray in the car, in the police car, blood on the, whatever the evidence is, that really has to be put out there, I think, to try to do everything authorities can do to diffuse this potential serious matter.
You know, there's word that the officer who shot Michael Brown is going to resign ahead of a decision. Do you think that would be a helpful move to diffuse tensions? Not helpful, Jack?
Gosh, I just don't know. I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah. It's one of those situations where no matter what happens, important to remind everyone that sometimes there's a distinction between what feels right and what the law actually says. But we're going to have to wait and see what happens when that decision comes down. I'd like to go to the calls for a moment because one of the big issues this week was the Bill Cosby story and all this news that a slew of women have come out accusing him of sexual assault years ago. His lawyer denies the charge, Bill Cosby himself not addressing it. Kim, you're calling from Sac County, Iowa. What's on your mind?
The Bill Cosby allegations have brought to home what happened to me back in 1981. With a man I knew, and I'm going to go to the sheriff's office and report it. I know there won't be any prosecution, but I want to be marked as one of those statistics.
Kim, thank you for this. Can you tell us a little more what about this made you decide to speak?
I've been living with it for a long time, and now that I'm older, I see the negative consequences of what happened and the way I reacted afterwards had long-term consequences for me, and this is just taking back a little power.
Kim, we applaud you and remind you there are a lot of resources out there, so please take advantage of them, and thanks for your call because it might motivate other people to come forward. And an important reminder, whatever one thinks of this particular story with Bill Cosby and the women, sometimes just talking about these issues in general, bringing the stories to light does help people with their own challenges and coming to terms with what happened in their lives. Ernie, calling from Plastow, New Hampshire, what's on your mind?
Hi, I just want to just ask a quick question. Maybe you listen on here and see what the response is. This is what I don't understand is why do these women wait so long to report something so terrible like this? I would like to see if any woman out there that could give me the response that have maybe been victim, but why wait so long, 30 or 40 years? You think if something like this happened to a woman, that she would speak up right away to prevent other women from becoming victims. I just don't get it. Why wait so long?
Ernie,
I don't get it. Maybe somebody out there could help me.
Ernie, thank you for the call. Jack, you know, it's interesting because just before Ernie called saying he doesn't understand the wait, we heard from Kim saying she waited years.
Yes.
Sometimes it's just too hard to speak about things that are just that personal.
Yes, and recall, I mean, if some of this happened in the 80s when there was a nimbus of, you know, of honor and dignity and pride around Bill Cosby, he was a national icon. And to come out and challenge him, to come out and you know, and all these things get to be he said, she said, to take that kind of risk, I can fully understand why someone wouldn't want to do that. What's happened just in recent years is that the whole climate for celebrities with the social media and so on has begun to shift. And now they're what used to give them immunity, their fame, now makes them more exposed.
It's true. It's an interesting take, and you've got so much tension here between the women and an exposed celebrity. And Dira, curious if you have a take on this Bill Cosby story.
I do have some thoughts on that, and specifically to the question by the caller, which I think is a valuable question to bring into the conversation because I think a lot of men might feel that way and wonder about that. And I think the answer has been given by many of these women who claim to be victims, who say that they were very young at the time. They were so-called nobodies in the world of Hollywood. Bill Cosby was already, you know, a hugely respected figure and celebrity, much beloved throughout the country, and they just did not believe they would be believed. And we hear that again and again and again, that a lot of men who are sexual predators do prey on women who are younger or more uncertain of their status, and that there's often a power dynamic. Not saying whether this case is true or not, but certainly these women have said that they were, you know, too young and did not believe they would be believed. And whether it's 10 years later or more, you know, some of them are older now, more sure of themselves and feel that they can speak out. You know, there was a very powerful piece a few days ago in the Washington Post by a woman who says that she was a victim and wrote about it years later. And that has, of course, caused a lot of this discussion. So I do think we are in a climate, as Jack said, not only with Twitter and social media making all sorts of things more public and discussion more possible for the ordinary person in a way that it wasn't possible 10 years, 20 years ago. And I also think that there's more understanding and knowledge about sexual assault. We hear about it on college campuses. And, you know, there's just much more discussion about it and knowledge than there was at the time of these alleged attacks.
And just covering the story and having it out there helps bring out these conversations, questions like Ernie's. Why do they wait so long? And experiences like Kim's to give him an answer. So it's an interesting and provocative conversation and one worth having. And let's go again to the phone. John is calling from Detroit, Michigan. John, what's your thought and what's your story of the week in the news?
In regard to Ferguson and the way that story is handled, I resent panels like yours that pretend there's any doubt what that grand jury is going to do. And anyone who thinks that that officer can work again anywhere is not realistic. There's no doubt what that grand jury is going to do. That district attorney did not do anything but dump the information in front of the grand jury and turn his back and walk away. And that's not normally what the function of a district attorney.
I presume you're saying you believe the grand jury will let him walk, will not charge him.
I'll bet you a paycheck.
Okay. Thank you for the call, John. And I understand the frustration. Also, in the news business, we cannot prejudge what a grand jury is going to do. But this is one we are still watching, and it's expected to come down any time now. Sometimes we have to make hard turns in the news, and we're making one right now to a much lighter story. This one is happening in upstate New York, where folks in Buffalo are experiencing Snowmageddon. They have been shut down, staying at home. I know we have listeners in Buffalo who might be listening to us from the comfort of your bed because there's just no reason to get up because you can't leave the house. Dana, you're not far from there, I guess. Not that close. But Washington, D.C., any snow there?
No snow, but it's definitely colder than it is where you're from and in sunny La La Land. But, you know, the thing is, we know people from Buffalo. We know that the thing about Buffalo is that they are sort of used to snow. So I keep watching the news thinking, really? At least, you know, in Washington, there's one flake of snow on the ground and everybody, the whole city shuts down. And Buffalo, you know, you think, well, they can handle it. But
it's so
then
true.
When you really get to understand how much snow is there. It, you know, the people have to dig out their front door, dig tunnels at their front door to get out. Oh, my gosh.
I know. Well, Wolf Blitzer himself is from Buffalo, so we know it breeds a hardy class of people. Jack, you actually are pretty close. You know folks who are struggling with this right now?
I don't, but I look at that weather map and I see that I'm only a couple of hundred miles away here, pretty much at the same latitude. And so you worry. You know, there's a wonderful phrase in a Waller Stevens poem called "The Mind of Winter." I think winter hasn't even begun and we're already in the mind of winter with these sorts of extravagance.
Racing
happening.
For the Arctic blast.
Yes.
And Indira Lakshmanan, I guess one of the many gifts of being a foreign policy correspondent is no one's going to deploy you to cover a snow story. Because Dana and I were always at risk, I know. So I want to thank our guest, Dana Bash of CNN. Such a joy to be on air with you again, Dana. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Jess. Thank you.
Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, great insight, such clarity. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty for the best perspective in the business. So great to talk.
Thanks so much, Jessica.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, we'll look at privacy, security, and the battle heating up between intelligence agencies and tech companies that are moving to encrypt your communication. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.